started. Are there any questions? Everybody looks very down. Okay. Anybody knows answers to this that you haven't learned from me? So actually, I didn't know this myself. I just figured this out the other day. Maybe I'm wrong, but actually, the first paper that was submitted on PageRank was submitted to SIGIR 1998, which is especially it's the top conference on information retrieval. And apparently, Kleinberg was doing the same similar work, and he met these guys at Stanford and tried to convince them that they should write a paper. These guys didn't want to write a paper; they wanted to make a company. But finally, they decided they will write a paper. And so which actually also means that something else I said on the email to you guys, that Kleinberg was actually first in coming up with the idea. At best, probably they were independent and at the same time. So at any rate, so they decided to cite each other and write papers. And so Kleinberg writes a paper to SODA, which is a symposium on discrete algorithms. He gets through. And these guys send a paper to SIGIR 1998, and we didn't read that paper because it was rejected. And apparently they told the guys that should concentrate more on information retrieval and less on web. And so so that's what, you know, obviously they didn't take the advice too seriously. So in fact, the first paper on PageRank that came out was Vanity Publication. So Stanford has this thing on Digital Libraries Initiative. And I think either Motwani or Terry Winograd, the advisors of these guys, were getting funding through that. So at some point of time, they wanted to have a big technical report on what's going on in that project. And so that's where this stuff appeared first. And then, of course, it appeared in www.1999 or 98, one of those, which is the anatomy paper that you guys get. And that's the only other paper. No other paper ever came out. So the other interesting thing is the patent for PageRank is owned by Stanford University because it was done in Stanford. And they have been nice enough to give an exclusive license to Google till 2011. So after that, anybody can use it. Already, everybody is using it and nobody is using it because the idea is actually also available separately through Kleinberg's work. But anyway, it's kind of interesting. So in fact, the current understanding as to what, if any, Google owns other than its name is that it knows the technology for dealing with 10,000 machines together at the same time. Okay, this is a humongous engineering feat. How many of you bothered to hear Urs Hoegele's talk on Linux clusters that I forwarded to you guys a while back? You should look it up. This was like a couple of years back. It's the engineering aspect of making something like Google run. And to some extent, and there was another article that I forwarded to you guys as to how I think Martin Farak, who was a professor at Rutgers, spent a sabbatical at Google, and then he tried to give talks about his experiences outside, and of course he has to get them okayed by the Google management. And every time he would try to say something about how many machines are there, etc., they'll cut out the last few zeros. Okay, they don't want anybody else to know. I mean, according to Martin Farak, they probably don't want their competition to know how hard it is. Okay, so it's easier for your competition to think that anybody can do it, try to do it, and not be able to do it, than to realize that it's not, you know, that it's not easy. So in essence, they have gone out of their way to mislead people as to how many machines they actually have to handle and what are the engineering problems. And that's to some extent, those are the boring things. Probably they won't make a good lecture, but that's very important if you want to make things scale. Okay. I would suggest you look at Urs Hoegele's Linux clusters, Google Linux clusters. Anyway, so we were looking at semantic annotations and I assume that you read the paper. I'm going to quickly go through it, and after this, I'm going to start talking about information integration, which is the next topic, which is sort of connected. You'll notice that information extraction is needed for information integration, but, you know, so this is the first step to some extent for that. So anyway, what Semtag and Seeker was trying to do is convert an HTML page, hopefully, into an automatically annotated RDF page with, you know, annotations about entities that it realizes are actually present in its knowledge base. So as I said last time, you have a background knowledge, and in essence, as soon as you connect up things here, the print, as I said, I really like that idea of print methods of these objects. These are semantic objects. They have relations between each other and so on. And all we are talking about is essentially print methods between, I mean, so the way this object is represented is in the string. And now you want to know that this actually, this is, there is an object here in your knowledge base which corresponds to that. The moment you make that pointer, then you have a connection between this and the rest of your knowledge. So that's a very useful thing to be able to do. So this in itself, as I said last time, you could talk about how do you get this, which is the background knowledge to begin with. And the other is how do you tag somebody else's page such that it becomes part of your background knowledge. It's connected to your background knowledge. Okay. The information extraction of the type that KnowItAll is trying to do is to get pieces of this directly. Okay, but that's more blue sky than I would say this idea, which is you start with some background knowledge, and then you essentially connect up the elements of your page to your background knowledge. Okay, I mean, you already actually are used to this. A normal HTML page has links to words on the page, and those links will take you to the pages that explain these things again as an HTML page. The only difference here is you're actually connecting it now to a semantic object, and so hopefully you can make connections about the relationship. Okay, so in the case of Semtag Seeker, this particular knowledge base is, they just started with one. It's not even the biggest one. It's the, I believe, the TAP ontology that was available in one of these projects at Stanford. Actually, I think the guy, how many of you noticed the interesting thing about the number of authors on these papers? Did you see how many number of authors are there? 11, 12, 13. In fact, when I was a grad student, I once had, I think somebody posted in there, outside their office, by that time, at that time, the longest number of authors paper. It's a biology paper. Normally, biology papers and any experimental science papers have a large list of authors, including the guy who cleans the equipment. You know, you have to give everybody their credit, right? So whereas he just come up with a theorem, whoever proves it, that's just one guy. You know, it doesn't, other people are standing saying, go, prove the theorem, but other than that, they're not really doing much. So your theoretical work normally has too few authors, and humongous experimental work such as this has large number of authors. It also gives you an idea as to, if you want to do some of this sort of work, you know, both KnowItAll and Semtag and Seeker, technically the ideas are not that hard. Okay, what was involved is, you can't just say, you know, imagine Semtag and Seeker saying, look, you know, we're going to do this, here is three pages that we tagged. They wouldn't have gotten into dub, let alone getting the best paper award. In 2003, this paper was the best paper of the conference. Okay, the reason they got the best paper, as if you read the paper, you'd know that they actually say that they have tagged some 234 million pages. Okay, so the thing that actually makes this work is not even discussed in this paper. It's the second part of the paper where they say the Seeker platform, which has pretty impressive statistics such as we can tag 10,000 pages per minute. Okay, I mean, and you guys are doing, you know, project 2 and project 3, and you know how fast you are running. You know, so it's, that's the sort of thing. I mean, you know, if you want to play this game, I mean, if you want to make, if you want to take your ideas, you know, have your ideas be taken seriously, you need to show that they scale. And the only way you show that they scale is by actually showing that you worked on 200 million pages or something. So that's a clean way. Okay. So they started with the TAP ontology, and actually the reason I brought this up is the guy, one of the guys of in the Semtag Seeker paper is R.V. Guha. He's one of the, I don't know what his number is in the number of authors, but there's a guy called R.V. Guha, who actually is the guy who supplied essentially the ontology. And Guha, those of you, we talked about Psych a while back. You know, Psych is this Doug Lennart's project. Guha used to be with Psych. He was actually Doug Lennart's right-hand man. And he used to basically try and write down background knowledge for the world once and for all using this Psych common sense knowledge base. Okay, and the TAP is Psych Lite, you know, if you want it that way. Okay, so he has that sitting around, and all he did was basically connect up the entities that he has in this ontology. I mean, all these guys were doing was the entities that they have in this ontology to actual print pieces in the paper. Okay, so that's what they were trying to do. There are a variety of annotations and all that stuff. Let's see, is there anything interesting here? Nothing. There are a couple of slides here talking about the fact that people annotate pages for both improving their readability to other users, other humans. In this case, of course, we're doing the annotation to improve their understandability to other programs, not necessarily humans. Okay. The fact that you connected up this print name to an entity in the ontology doesn't help humans in any bit, anyway. Okay, but it helps your programs because they can then do inferences on them. Okay, let's see. So the ideas, of course, are that you want to hopefully improve search. You want to be able to say things such as if X is a colleague of Y, Y is then a colleague of X. You want to be able to say that if I think the previous one is about this basketball thing, so you want to be able to say, for example, that there may be other teammates to this one guy. You know, there may be team members, in this team, for example, and then you could connect up that piece of information you have. Okay, so obviously understanding it will help, and understanding it even at a shallow level would help. I don't know. Okay, so. Semtag and Seeker essentially was trying to do this at a reasonable scale. It's already 2 years old. There are other papers just like this. This is not the only thing. They actually discussed some of them. But it's again, I brought this up because it's a kind of a good exemplar. So they started with TAP ontology, which is about 72,000 concepts. That's it. So there are only 72,000 nodes in this connected network of concepts. Okay. And then they crawled some gazillion web pages, and then they extracted some several million semantic tags from this. Notice that not the entire page doesn't have to be tagged. If you see useful pieces, it's just like the way you put HTML links, hyperlinks in a page. Like if you look at Wikipedia entry, they don't put a hyperlink for every little word there. A couple of words which are also actually corresponding to some other entries in the Wikipedia, they put a link to it. Okay, so I guess the interesting question, of course, is when you put these kind of tags, again, this is the issue of precision versus recall. Okay, how many tags did you put, and how many of the tags that you put are actually correct tags? Both are important. Okay, so basically, if you are looking at about that or that, so they're looking for about two tags per page, that's all. Okay, and the question is, are they correct? And I think they argue that about 82% of the tags that they made, that they were actually making, were correct. It boggles my mind as to how they actually came up with that number, because did they hire grad students to go through 434 million tags to check which are correct, which are wrong? I have no idea. But this is the number that they give in the paper. Okay. So let's look at pieces of this thing. TAG, the TAP is, you know, a piece of psych. Think of it as a, you know, a small piece of common sense knowledge. Okay, it's not complete in any sense. And so it has lexical and taxonomic information about basically, you know, some things like music, movies, sports, etc. That's basically what they have apparently. And so there is this one issue that we did talk about last time. If you were to tag it, how, you know, where do you remember the tags? Because, you know, web is a read-only web, not a write-read web. So it's basically, it's not a big deal, but it's worth noticing that then you would have a sort of an annotation bureau. They actually call it label bureau in the paper. And so what this label bureau does is it essentially has tagged versions of all the pages in the world. Okay, now that's not particularly outlandish. We already have copies of all the pages in the world in Google, right? They're caching every darn page that they crawl. And, you know, that led to all sorts of interesting ethical issues as to, you know, if you call somebody some names once and then you took the page down, you know, Google will remember it forever and ever. Okay? Actually, not forever and ever. I mean, as long as you rewrite the page, its cache changes. If you just took the page down, then the cache can remain, you know. Anyway, if you, I mean, so basically, it's not out of the realm of feasibility. So instead of a cache of the web, you now have labeled cache of the web. Okay? There are also, by the way, how many of you know the Web Archive project, Internet Archive project? So that is actually the one which, if they ever crawl you, then you're dead. Okay, so if you call somebody a name and then you change it, they still have it because they have the version of January 1999 of your homepage still has you calling your friend names, and so they just store it. Okay, so that's basically, you know, what is that thing called? I mean, versioned archive of the web. Okay, actually, if you haven't seen it, you should go by and look at look at the history of web on that, which is basically history is a weird word to use in the context of web, given that web didn't exist in any real fashion till 1995. But it's interesting to see the very first page of Amazon, our very first page of Google, our very first page of Yahoo. Okay, how geeky were they in that? Okay, but you know they have it in this Internet Archive. So anyway, what these guys are trying to do is they're trying to do labeled version of the web somewhere, and this is basically saying, you know, we have the big solution worked out, and we're going to do pieces of it now for you. Okay, so the pieces. So this is this bureau thing. And the pieces that they do have essentially is what they do is once you have these pages that you crawled, you're going through the spotting phase where they're essentially looking for pieces in this document, tokens in the document that can potentially be instances of a label in their, in their ontology. So think of it as these are the tokens whose which these are the strings which correspond to print names of things that are there in the ontology. Okay, so if there is an entity called Chicago Bulls, okay, and there is a string called Chicago Bulls in some place in the document, then presumably this string Chicago Bulls is corresponding to the entity Chicago Bulls in your knowledge base. Upfront you would think this is just a one-to-one correspondence, there's no question. But as I was saying towards the end of last class, it's possible that the same thing, same print name can be had by multiple objects. Okay, print name is but a projection. It's just, you know, it's like saying you are represented by your shirt color. Okay, and so lots of people might have the same shirt color on a particular day, and so they're not, you know, you do have one shirt color, but it's not up, the backward mapping is not one-to-one. Okay, so when that happens, essentially, they have to see whether the Chicago Bulls that they have in their knowledge base is the same as Chicago Bulls that they have in this text. The way you normally do it is by understanding the document, okay, quote-unquote understand. You read this, you read that, and you say, yeah, they're the same. Now, obviously, they can't do any such thing. So what they are doing, essentially, is to do vector space similarity. Okay, so they're looking for the context in which Chicago Bulls appeared in the page. The context is defined very simply as 10 words before, 10 words after the token. Just like, you know, context for a hyperlink was defined as a few words before and a few words after the hyperlink. Remember that question in the midterm? So now you're defining context. In some sense, these words are hyperlinks. They are potential hyperlinks to semantic objects. Okay? So you're looking at the context by looking at the words around it. So now you have a little bag of words, which is a document. And anytime you say bag of words, it's like a document, because that's how we consider documents. So the question then is, what's the bag of words corresponding to this particular instance of Chicago Bulls in your ontology? So they have to have gone through a learning phase where for every object in the ontology, there's a bag of words corresponding to it, saying these are the words that normally appear around this particular use of this concept. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this is basically, you know, what they're doing. And so in the learning path, they look at corpus-wise distribution of terms for each internal node in the taxonomy, so each concept. So it's actually possible, according to these guys, in this way, that the same print name can actually be appearing in two different places in the ontology. But then in each place, its bag of words will be different. To the extent they have different meanings, they also have different bag of words. And to figure out where to link the particular instance that you have in front of you, you take the semantic similarity, you take the vector space similarity between the context in the page and the stored context for this in your ontology. Okay. Now, again, sometimes there is this, you know, perverse logic to this. We already know that words without order don't have any meaning, but they seem to work. So let's milk more of it. Okay, more of this magic. I mean, it's a magic that you can't explain in any rational sense. And yet, since it seems to work for search, why not use it one more level? You know, so use it also in terms of defining meaning in terms of the context. Okay? Again, it's not going to be foolproof. What's interesting is, I mean, what the question is, what do you expect as to the precision of this sort of tagging that you do? You know, I would say anything above 0%, I'm pretty happy. And, you know, they actually are saying 82%, which is pretty darn good. Okay. Okay, so that's basically a representative sample. And then during the tagging class, you take the instance context, compare it to the stored context. Okay. This business of bag of words has been overloaded. I mean, not overloaded. What do you call this? It's been coerced into all sorts of uses. You know, here is a use where, you know, you're actually trying to consider context connection between two hyperlinks. I mean, to a concept here and a concept in the ontology. And you already saw a version of it where you're deciding whether a hyperlink from this page is worth considering given this query. And to do that, you take the context around the hyperlink and compare it to the query. Right? That's another use of the same bag of words similarity idea. So once you have a similarity idea, you can try to misuse it in many, many ways. That's basically what they're doing here. Okay. So here is an example of a scenario where the same, an object with the same print name, that's why I like the word print name, appears under three different places in your ontology, in your, you know, concept hierarchy. Okay, one is cat, jaguar is a kind of a cat. One is football, presumably I think jaguars are some sort of football team, don't ask me. And one is cars, and jaguar is a kind of a car. Okay, all of them have the same exact print name. So if you see jaguar, in the web page, you need to figure out which jaguar is this. Otherwise, you have three connections from your print name to the thing. So this is the kind of case where presumably the context that they computed for jaguar under cars and under football and the cat would be different. Context is a big name for bag of words. So now you compare this bag of words to the actual bag of words that appear in your instance, and you can pretty much see how it might work out. Okay? So this is the context, 20 words. the associated similarity function they use is basically a TF-IDF matrix, and they go through some discussion as to exactly how they pick that TF-IDF matrix. So, for example, I think the next slide has something about it. So they took a 200,000 word lexicon, and so all the vectors are in terms of those 200,000 words now. Okay, and then you have TF-IDF matrix for those. Okay. Nice, right? I mean, something that you learned, a little idea you learned, and you're reusing or misusing it in many other ways. Okay, so this is this 82% accuracy. Has anybody actually read it? Does anybody remember exactly how they come up with this 82% accuracy number? Is it on a sampling based thing? They took like some, thousand of the tags of the 434 million tags, and they found that they were 82% accurate. Because in my mind boggles as to how you would actually count all the 434 different tags and see which are right, which are wrong.
I don't see how else they could do it.
You could do sampling.
With statistics.
Oh, that's what you mean. Yeah, okay, yeah, probably.
With the statistics, what a confidence interval.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah.
I've 95%.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's probably what they did. Probably what they did. Good. What? Yeah. How do these opinion polls work out? Okay, currently only 42% like Bush. Does anybody actually tell you 42% of the 1001 suckers who actually, agreed to take our calls, right? So it's always based on a sample, and we assume that if you do random sampling correct, I see your point. Yeah. I know, but I mean, nobody repeats that part. What people remember is the percentage, and to the extent it's accurate or not depends on whether it was a truly random sample. Okay. So that's about Semtag and Seeker. Any questions on this stuff? Okay. So I actually think that the interesting connections here. You just use something like mutual information and a naive-based classifier to do information extraction, which you didn't think was, I don't know that I would have thought that would be possible. At least that's what KnowItAll is doing. And similarly, you're doing TF-IDF similarity to do tagging. So, you could think of it either as for a guy with a hammer in hand, everything looks like a nail, or you could think of it as a very smart way of using your limited tools for many, many purposes. Okay, so we still don't do any, NLP. Although in the KnowItAll case, we did do the syntax analysis. By the way, so this, actually, if you check this out, I was saying earlier that there are a lot of off-the-shelf pieces of software which can take English and do tagging, and do syntactic analysis of English, okay? So I believe this is the one you guys use, right? So Taufik and Co. use this for the collaborative curation thing. And so you can actually try this out, experiment with the parser, okay? So tell me a sentence. Okay, so that looks like a reasonably complex sentence. And you submit it, it'll come up with syntactic analysis. Okay, in terms of noun phrases. And so in fact, this here is your little, this should not be surprising at all, by the way. I mean, if you've done any natural language processing course, you would do ATN-based parsing of sentences, augmented translation networks. That's old stuff. You know, that's like, you know, NLP 101 for syntax. Now there are better versions, extended versions of syntactic parsing. Okay. So the theory of it, I'm not even going into. And as far as we are concerned, it works. And, you know, it's a reasonable thing. So in fact, if I remember, you could also try, I'll send you the link for this, but if you say link grammars, you'll get this. You could also try, let's say, the one that we tried, countries, cities, such as Seattle and Phoenix are bursting at the seams. Okay, something like that. Okay, and if you go here, okay, so it's basically saying noun phrase cities, which has two more noun phrases, Seattle, Phoenix. So you could write that little rule saying whenever you have noun phrase such as noun phrase, then take the heads of the following noun phrases and say those are just instances of the first noun phrase. Okay. Again, I mean, I just thought it's worth seeing this because even if you don't understand how it is done, you know that there are tools out there. Okay. Okay. So let me summarize what we did in the information extraction and then move on to the next topic. So information extraction can be motivated either as explicating more structure from the data or as an automated way to semantic web. At least two different motivations. You can, whichever you like, you can use, okay? Different papers, you know, motivated in different ways. Now, extraction complexity depends on whether the text you have is either is either template formed or free form. Template form means, in essence, some program converted a tuple into pseudo English. So it would convert every tuple into pretty much similar looking, syntactically similar looking pseudo-English. Okay, so it would be easy to extract the tuple from the template by essentially doing regular expressions. Okay, looking for particular expressions or looking for, in the paper that I asked you to read, looking for landmarks, which is basically specific words. Okay, because all of them have the same structure, not just syntactic structure. You could almost look for particular words and say, skip up to that point, then grab a couple of words after that, skip on to the next point, and grab another few words. Okay. And again, I think one thing that we didn't do much here, and I hope you would look at the paper that I put a link to, is how to learn these regular expressions. That's actually a very nifty idea. It turns out that if I label, that's a paper that's by Knobloch, Minton, and Lerman, which I discussed very briefly in the first class on information extraction. But I also have given you a paper in the readings. And that one at least gives you some high-level description of how do they learn the regular expression corresponding to unwrapping. Okay. One other interesting thing, of course, is, as I said, in these cases, it's all positive examples. There are no negative examples. Okay, so what you're looking for are regular expressions that as tightly capture the positive examples as possible. In fact, I think in this paper or some other paper, they basically say also that all the training examples are seen as positive examples, and every other randomly generatable example is seen as a negative example. That's one way, if you want to have negative as well as positive. Okay. But there are also other ways of just doing positive example-based learning, which is you find the smallest description that captures all your positive examples. Okay. Now, of course, smallest description depends upon what language are you using and how are you counting small. But, you know, that's the interesting aspect there. Okay, so that's one. And then extraction from free-form text requires natural language processing. It can be done in terms of parts of speech tagging, at least. You know, we looked at some examples of that in the context of Noetra. Okay, and then we also looked at this idea that, a closely related idea, to information extraction is annotations, which is just connecting up what's in the page to something that's a semantic hierarchy that you have in the background. And basically we saw that it too can be automated, and at least we saw one example approach. Okay, there are many approaches for this, many approaches for this. I was just asking you to at least understand one exemplar approach. That's basically about, so actually this guy, this is the slide of some guy who I took, and there are at least some more and automatic annotation systems that you can look at. Questions? Okay. So, what I would talk about for starting today, for next several classes, maybe two, three, maybe even four classes, depending on how it goes, are issues involved in putting together multiple sources of information. And I'm using the word information here loosely. It could be data, which is basically structured tuples, or it could be textual sources. Okay? At least today we'll talk more about structured tuples, such as relational data. And so the simplest idea is basically, if you have multiple databases out there, is there a way in which I can develop a single mediator, a single point of contact with the entire set of databases on the web, and through which you ask questions, and then the mediator then basically decides which database to ask, you know, to redirect these questions to, and ask the questions, collects the answers, comes back and gives you the answers. Okay? So what we are interested in doing is figuring out some of the issues involved in doing that. So the idea that basically I have here is, you know, here is the big bad web on the other side. It has all sorts of stuff. You know, that's why I use the word information right now. You could have structured databases, which are the cylinders normally, web pages, which are your parallelograms, and services, which are your suns, and sensors and streaming data. You know, in fact, sensors are streaming data. If you have a sensor anywhere, which is sensing the temperature, it keeps sending the current temperature. So it's streaming data piece by piece for you. If you have all these things in front of you. So the question is, you know, normally we have these databases on the web. Web is there, so that there is like a common medium over which you can access all these guys. Right now, you or I access these independently. If we have a question in our head, we'll go to this, get some information, and feed it into this, get that, get some more information, feed into the third one. And we do all the work, in essence. We don't seem to be complaining, but currently we do all that work. Okay? So the question is there something that we can make up here in between, which will essentially take a single query, so the single point of contact where you take the query, and the query is then somehow essentially the versions of that query are sent to the right information sources, and the answers are put together back, and they're returned to the user. So that's the dream. Okay? Now we'll see pieces of this are realizable and pieces of that are hard. Part of what we'll be doing is figuring out, first of all, what's the lay of the land, and secondly, which pieces are actually realizable right now. Okay. So, I mean, here are my version of it as to what you might need in this big black box. You know, you might need at least some information. So this is the guy called a mediator. So you're trying to design this mediator, this program, okay? It needs to know about its user, about its database, data sources, or information sources that it's mediating over. So you are the broker in some sense, okay? So you're outsourcing this guy's query to people here, okay? So you need to know your user, you need to know your backroom employees, which are these data sources, okay? And then, of course, you need some information about the sources, you need some information about, and then given a query, you need to figure out, in a sense, which parts of this are should be sent to which pieces of the data sources, okay? And then how to combine the answers and get back to the user. Now this is very high level. All I'm trying to tell you is these are the pieces, and hopefully we will flesh more and more of it as we go on. Okay, and then after you do this, you come up with what should be asked. So imagine this guy says, I want, you know, if you are an outsourcing mediator, okay, so somebody says, you know, here is a little program that I want to be developed. And you have a bunch of people that, you know, can write programs. And so you split this into some pieces that different people can work on. And then you need to actually then send it to them and get it done. So that's the database part, that's the execution part. So the queries are actually being sent to the independent individual sources, and the answers are being put together. Okay, so at the minimum, you need these, and you know, I don't think we are going too much into detail when we, there's not too much particularly surprising here that you need at least these pieces, okay? And then you can write a lot more inside, and as I go one every successive level, I'm probably going more and more on the limb as to what should be there, you know, depending upon. I think many more people working in the information integration would agree that there should be a big box between this guy and the web. And, you know, half of the people would leave the room when you said those big box has three, you know, four small boxes. And even more people might leave the room when you say actually the blue stuff is what is needed in each piece. So these are sort of, as you flesh this out, you're sort of articulating what you think would be the solution. Okay. So this is my view of some of the solutions here. Okay, so source trust, for example, needs descriptions of the sources. Source fusion needs to be able to handle composing different sources. So you take the answer from one and send it to other guy. So that's sort of a composition. And then also this whole interesting. This is essentially your query processing aspect. So you are now trying to process a query optimally over outside databases. If this was a traditional database, then you still need to do query planning, except you know the only database that you're working on, you know it in and out. Okay, so if you want to write traditional database in the context of this picture, essentially there's just one guy here, that's it. There's nobody else. And that one guy is totally subservient to you. They will give you all the information about that database. The tricky part here is the web doesn't even know you exist. You, the mediator, exist. In fact, if they find out, they might think you're doing something illegal and shut you down. You know, who asked you to combine my data with somebody else's data? Maybe it's illegal. Maybe I didn't want you to do it. Okay. But these are, in fact, those are also issues. When you're trying to combine databases on the web, there are issues of who owns the data. And, you know, am I allowed to combine? Okay. So I would not even get into that right now, but, you know, the fact is that these data sources may not even know that this mediator exists. And so they are not going to give to the mediator, you know, excruciating details about their capabilities, what they're able to do, what they're not able to do. And they may not be willing to give excruciating details about the statistics, even if you're thinking only in terms of relational databases. If you want to do effective query processing on a relational database, you need statistics on it, right? Like selectivities, cardinalities, and so on. You know, for normal databases, you just, you know, every night you compute them. Here, you don't have access to the innards of any database. All you have access to is all of these queries that you send to these outside data sources are through forms. Whatever forms are exposed through web. So the question then would be, how do you basically overload the form to get whatever information you want? And you already saw one example. So for example, Google won't give you all the information you want about a query. Right? You know, it will say you have 335,000 answers to your query. Here are top 10. And if you keep pestering me, I'll give you up to top 1,000, and then I'll stop. I'll not give you any more. And so you had to figure out a way of how to use the restricted access that you're given to make it give the rest of the answers, if there is a way. In fact, that's what KnowItAll was doing, for example, in that recursive query expansion thingy. Okay? So the same sort of issues can happen here, which is given that you have a form-oriented access to the databases, which basically is not full uncontrolled access, are you even able to answer all the queries? Okay. And are you able to, and upfront sometimes it looks as if you can't answer. So for example, if I thought, just you know, if you woke me up and asked, you know, Google says they'll give you 300,000 of the results, but they're only giving 1,000. What will you do? I'll just say, no, don't wake me up. I'll go back to sleep. I don't think it can be done. Okay? But it actually can be done. And, you know, the fact that I thought it can't be done was poverty of my imagination. And you don't want your mediator to have poverty of imagination, in essence. Okay? So because then it won't be able to answer queries that actually can be answered. Okay? So to do all that, essentially it needs to have whatever information it has about the sources probably has to be learned automatically because nobody, it's not necessarily going to be exported by the sources. And it needs to find a way of using that information to do the query processing. Okay? Was there a question somewhere? Okay. So here are, you know, some examples of where this sort of idea of, you know, integrating multiple information sources could be useful. There are a lot more examples that you could think of, but these are some. For example, on the world, in the public web, comparison shopping is an example that you are all aware of. There are a large number of comparison shopping sources, and that's something that you're aware of. In the science and culture, for example, in many science disciplines, there is this big issue. There is a big issue of having multiple data sources which need to be combined. So for example, in biology, there are several data sources that people independently curate and maintain. Okay? And right now what happens is you the biologist would go to each of these separately. Okay? So the question would be, is there a way in which you can have an integrated interface to all these sources? That's a very useful thing to do. And you could do this in other domains too. Biology is one example. You know, we were looking recently at some similar kind of applications in anthropology, where they have their own data sources, and the data sources don't talk to each other. Okay, and you want to have an integrated access, an integrated mediator over all the databases. And then this is another thing. Companies have, apparently this is a very interesting statistic. An average size company apparently has 49 different databases. I didn't know this. Okay, I don't know what average here is, but I guess presumably average is somewhere little below Fortune 500 companies. And they have a large number of databases. And this is, I can give you the study for this in case you're interested in. And they spend a lot of time making sure that pieces from these different sources will come together. Okay, and I think I may have mentioned to you this example from NSF, where one time NSF wanted to find out the answer to a simple question, exactly how much of the money in the last 5 years have we given to historically black colleges, because they were trying to figure out, you know, whether they're supporting minority institutions doing research. And it seems like a very simple thing, and apparently it took highly paid IT staff 1 week to figure out the answer, because the answer is spread in multiple databases. Okay. So there are some of the examples of what would be, I mean, what you could do if you can integrate databases or information sources. Now, a couple of slides on why this is different or not the same as something else that you already looked at. Okay. So one is, of course, why isn't it just Google, or why isn't it just MetaCrawler, which would be working on, you know, if MetaCrawler is a search engine which calls other search engines. Okay. The basic idea is you want answers, not links to where there might be answers. Okay. And ultimately, all search engines do is to provide you with links to where they think there may be answers. Okay. So that's basically the main difference. Are there any questions on this thing? Okay. Now, here are some examples or non-examples. So, is Expedia, Travelocity, all these things, are they doing information integration, for example? Okay, these are all travel services, right? So if you call Expedia, you're able to get flights. I mean, you have to go to America West separately, Southwest separately to find out the flights, you know, and their prices. If you ask Expedia, it tells you all the flights. And, you know, in the order of, you know, these things. So, in some sense, it's integrating. Okay? Actually, it is integrating, except it doesn't have to do anything like what we discussed earlier. Because it turns out that most airlines essentially just put their data in one single database called Sabre database. Okay? The only guys who don't do it are who? Southwest. And so, we still have to go to Southwest separately and use their web page separately if you want to find out how much Southwest will charge you. They don't put their they don't put their price structure in Sabre database. Everybody else puts it in Sabre. Okay. So in essence, Expedia is really doing what your travel agent was doing in old times. Okay. Travel agent essentially had a single front end to Sabre database. Okay. Now Expedia is that travel agent. That's it. So the outside effect is similar. You know, you are able to integrate over multiple airlines. But in some sense, the problem was easier because all the airlines came together and decided to put all their data in one single database, which is pretty darn nice. Okay. They might be having second thoughts as to whether that's a smart idea or not, given how well Southwest is doing. But at least right now, you know, it's been a while since Southwest has been bucking the trend, and nobody else has skipped Sabre for them. It's worth knowing that that's an interesting difference. I mean, it's not an obvious example of data integration, okay, because there's a single database. Okay. There are actually hard problems that these databases do have to solve, and they don't solve it. I mean, the Expedia is supposed, if you actually, there is a different issue as to if you are trying to find an optimal ticket in terms of whatever your optimum is, you know, either the amount of money spent or the length of trip, whichever you want. Okay, if you want optimal, and probably optimal, okay, it turns out that problem is computationally very hard. I forget now whether it was undecidable or not, but it's pretty bad. Okay, there's a link there which actually talks about this as to the computational complexity of just finding optimal routes on the publicly available airline data, which should not be surprising to you, by the way, because it's a large graph and you're doing, you know, optimal search on the graph. Okay, and it turns out that there are enough constraints on the search that, you know, there are variations of it which are actually pretty darn costly. And the guys who actually almost wrote papers on this are the people who made Orbitz. You know Orbitz, that nobody, you know, the second best one or third best one, whatever. The Orbitz actually started off as something else, ITA software, okay? And it was written in Lisp, by the way. Those of you who have learned Lisp and don't know where else to use it, you know, it's actually Orbitz is written completely in Lisp. And, you know, in essence, the ITA software, ITA software is still available on the web, but they won't let you buy the ticket. The version which actually allows you to buy the ticket is Orbitz, which does less than what ITA software does. Except, you know, airlines told them, you know, don't look for too much optimization. You know, there are some advantages in terms of placement as to who comes, you know, who is put in the top. Okay. One of the other interesting things is things like Expedia don't even bother about giving optimum of any kind. Okay, so for example, what they're interested in is giving you an answer as fast as possible. Okay, and if the database doesn't, you know, times out on one of the queries, they just ignore it. So there have been many days where, you know, I would check what I think is the optimal ticket, and then I'll check it again after an hour, and what I thought was an optimal ticket was actually 10th optimal. There's a much better one higher up. Okay, because now previously, whatever the queries that timed out, it didn't even tell you that it timed out. It just shows as if these are the best answers. Okay. So the point I'm trying to make here is there are interesting technical issues as to how to do what, and the technical issues involved in finding optimal travel plans using publicly available data. Okay. But data integration is not one of them, because all data is actually in single format, in one single database. Yes, sir. So you're trying, would Google, news.google, is it doing information integration?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah. So news.google actually does do information integration, okay, of some sort, because it's a classic case where they do not have cached answers. I mean, they don't maintain a single database. What they have are all the results from various databases, and when you click on it, you actually go to that news source, okay? Except they're doing pretty much one simple thing, which is, put a link to where the actual article exists. Okay, there is no real joining involved. You're not saying, if the New York Times said this, you then, you know, submit it to Washington Post, and then compute some results, which makes no sense in news articles. But in databases, it does make sense. According to this database, this employee's social security number is this. Now I plug this social security number into this database to find out their home address. Okay, and then I plug this into MapQuest to find out the directions. Okay, and then I plug that into FTD Florist to send them flowers or whatever. That's actual integration of data split in multiple sources. Okay, but news.google.com is doing interesting kinds of integration. We will talk about this. In some sense, if all your sources are text sources, okay, then all the issues of integration would be, there are still issues of integration. For example, how would you present related information together? One of the nice things that Google says it tries to do is in a sense clustering all similar results, all similar articles together. Okay, so for example, if you say 2,400 similar articles, they'll say first whatever is the current top thing, and then 2,400 similar articles from different places. Now, none of us actually check whether the 2,400 ones that they have are really similar to this or not. If you take time and check, you'd find many of them are not similar at all. Okay? And they're only similar in the sense of, high level sense of maybe vector similarity to some extent. And, you know, human users would not actually consider them to be similar at all. Okay, so there are, but they do that. They at least do that similarity-based clustering. That's in some sense a kind of clustering issue there. Okay, we will mention the, I mean, we'll get to news.google.com a little bit more again later when we look at this issue of doing integration over text collections, text databases is basically been called collection selection. Okay, you think of each database. Washington Post is a text collection. New York Times is a text collection. Okay. And so you're trying to do collection selection on that. Okay, so one of the interesting issues would be something that news.google doesn't, you know, make you think about, which is, if I have a query, and suppose at the time the query is submitted, okay, so one of the interesting things would be, I actually submit a query to news.google.com. Now, currently, most of us use it according to its own front page, which is, suspiciously enough, I don't know whether you noticed it or not, on the right-hand side, there's always two articles on Google, apparently. You know, anything ever written about Google would somehow show up on the top right-hand side. You know, I find it hard to believe that it's an objective popularity index. You know, it's like popularity is one of these things where you put it up, people will click long enough that it will become actually popular. So one way of becoming popular is to put your name in the CNN front page, and you will become popular, okay? And most of us don't have that advantage because we don't run CNN, but Google does run news.google.com. So I'm not convinced that, in fact, Google coming, news articles about Google coming on the very top right-hand side is actually an objective indication that these are the most important news stories. But they do that right now, okay? So whatever they show, we consider that to be what we should be looking at. But suppose you use news.google in this following sense. You decided that you are interested in finding articles corresponding to some keyword query. So you make up your keyword query. I am interested in a recent accident that happened on the suburbs of Beirut, Lebanon. Okay, so I give keywords. I want all the articles about that. Okay, then the interesting question would be something like news.google.com would basically have to first decide which of its 4,200 sources to call with these keywords. Okay, I'm not even sure whether currently they allow this, but if they were going to allow online querying of all these 4,200 sources, then they have to decide which of the 4,200 sources are really worth calling to find out articles about Lebanon, Beirut accident, and then what order to call them. Okay, I mean the simplest idea would be to call everybody, call all 4,200 of them, and then they'll give answers. You know, you give them keywords, they'll always give them answers, give you answers. Then the question would be, these are the top five answers from this source, these are the top five from this source, these are the top five from this source. How do you fuse them together into a global top five? Okay, those are issues that come up in even news.google.com. Okay, and we will come back to it a little later. Another question? Okay, let's see. So this is slightly more technical issue, which is why isn't this just databases, distributed databases? Okay, I mean there are distributed databases, right? How many of you have taken anything on distributed databases? Okay, so why isn't information integration just distributed databases? So distributed databases is really centralized distributed databases. Somebody is in charge of all the distribution. Okay, you tell this database should have this database should have this data, and you decide how the data is. If there is replication among multiple databases, you decide, you being one single guy in the middle. Okay, and that same single guy also does query processing. And so in some sense, a query processor has all the data about the data sources in the distributed database. Except they, instead of being just in one single database, they are now in multiple databases. I decided where to put them, so I know how to get them. Whereas the data sources on the web don't even know you exist. And they clearly don't care that they should tell you how much they replicate each other. Multiple sources can be mirrors and you have no clue. Okay, some sources can be quite disreputable. They actually do opposite of the correct answer. And they won't tell you this. Whereas if it's your databases, you know, at least you know the quality of the data. You know consistency of the data. You know the replication of the data. You know everything about it. Okay? So the important thing is distributed databases is really much more control. I mean, distributed databases looks like less control than single traditional database. But it's still, in terms of control for the middle guy, the mediator, they're much more control for the mediator than what we are looking for, where people don't even know the mediator exists. The other sources don't even know. Okay? I mean, look at the rest of the stuff, but essentially that's the main important difference. So I do think that the two examples of good information integration systems out there are, as I said, text collection selection systems, such as news.google.com, and then the myriads of comparison shopping agents. Okay, they are also, in essence, at least taking information from multiple places. However, they don't take information from one thing and feed it into another thing, necessarily. So we sort of do what one might call vertical information integration. So you have a bunch of things, all of them exporting the same exact type of data, right? So new source 1, new source 2, new source 3, new source 4 are seller 1, seller 2, seller 3, seller 4. And then you're trying to integrate them. That's a special case, at least, of the general case that I was looking at. But they're available right now. Okay? And so we will look at some of the issues that comparison shopping agents actually handle. And then what else can be done? Okay. Okay. So what I would do is get started with giving some of the one more level down into those black boxes. Okay. So we are trying to figure out issues involved in designing all of these. Okay. So the general picture, as I said, is for now let's assume that we are actually looking at, unless I say otherwise, let's assume that we are actually looking at relational data sources. So all the guys on that side are relational data sources. So in a sense, we are talking about data integration now, okay, which is a special case of this bigger thing that I talked about. So all the user queries are placed on a central schema, okay? Call that the mediated schema. So each data source has a schema, right? So instead of having multiple different schemas, you now have one schema called mediated schema. And you know the user only knows that mediated schema, and then they're writing queries on that. Okay, from the point of view of the user, this may well mean that they have a single form to fill. That's all. They don't necessarily have to know what a schema is. They have a single form to fill. They fill that form, and then somebody else behind their back decides how this form query is sent to different sites. Okay, data is stored in the sources in different formats, in different schemas. Okay, for example, as an example, each of these sources can be employment opportunities. And employment opportunities can be stored in relational databases, okay? With some attributes being text, but many other attributes being having structure, okay? So if you have multiple employment opportunity databases, each of them have a separate schema, slightly different attribute name, et cetera, and you have a single mediated schema on which you fill a single form, and you get the query. So hopefully the idea would be, how would you then query all of them at the same time without you having to manually access all of them separately? That's an example here. Okay, yes? It's a good point. We'll talk about it. Actually, since you asked, I'll tell you this following question, which is, one way of doing this is data warehousing. Okay, how many of you know what data warehousing is? Okay, there are multiple data, so let me, since you asked me, and you know, enough people are looking as if they're falling about asleep, let me just show you this, which this is what you're integrating, but let me just show you this. So one way of actually integrating this kind of sources would be data warehousing, which is, I understand that the data exists in multiple databases, but I'll bring them all, convert them into a single schema, store them in my backyard. So if Sabre doesn't exist, I will make Sabre exist. And then I can just live with single database based query processing.
Can we say like data
No, it's not necessary. It may be known to you. So what I'm saying is, the designer of this mediator system may well know that Washington Post seems to have employment advertisements this way, and New York Times seems to have employment advertisements this way. And so you know what the schema is, you the designer. So if you're in the middle and copying it over into a central database, what you do is you write wrappers, one for New York Times, one for San Francisco Chronicle, one for Washington Post, and the wrapper essentially unwraps the data, puts it into your field. And this is the most popular doable form of data integration, which involves not doing data integration, basically. So essentially, you remove the problem by putting everything in your backyard. And you know, one of the interesting issues is we'll talk about pluses and minuses of this, okay? The plus is obvious. You don't need to know anything more. You know, you just know once you have the single database, the database is next to you. What's the minus? What? So the question is, how fast is your data changing? How fast is your data changing? Okay? Is it required? So if the data is not changing too fast, so in fact, most of the employment, so in fact, several companies made their millions by saying they would basically integrate all the employment opportunities. And apparently, every 3 years, some company can come and say this, and they become big again. Okay. So the one of the earliest ones is Jungly, which essentially did exactly data warehousing. Okay. What they would do is they have a handwritten wrapper for like 15 or 16 newspapers, newspaper online sources. From them, they will bring the employment ads down, put it into a single schema that they decided, and then user only has access to the data that they have stored, and they only answer with respect to the data that they have stored. So, in between two updates, I might be missing, you know, if there was a new employment opportunity that came up in last 5 seconds, you won't see it. To the extent employment opportunities are not that time sensitive, you don't mind. Imagine a data warehousing approach to essentially stock market. I want to provide, I know that none of you have any money, but if you had money, right, and you might want to basically do arbitrage possibilities, right? You would want to consider how much is a particular stock worth in New York Exchange versus Berlin Exchange versus Zurich Exchange, and then to the extent it's, you know, slightly cheaper here, slightly costlier here, you want to buy it here, sell it there, or vice versa, I don't even know. I mean, I don't make too much money. But, you know, use the numbers and, you know, and make money, right? Now, I'll give you 3 days old data, right? Of what use is it? Completely useless, okay? So there are cases where you actually need to be able to access the data online. And there are cases where you can copy the data over to a central warehouse and it makes your life much simpler. Okay, now I made it sound as if central warehouse is a dumb idea. It's not, actually. In fact, in biology, for example, take something like biology, which is neither stock market nor employment opportunities. Okay, it's biology. So if you are talking about integrating biological databases, there are people arguing that it should be done by online access because, you know, these things are, you know, changing continually. And so you should have a way in which, based on the query, you get the answer, by actually talking to individual databases at the query time. The difference is, in the case of data warehouse, you talk to the databases before the query time, overnight. And at the query time, you're only talking to your local database. In the case of virtual integration, which is the other word, which is the other type, you are actually talking to the databases at the query time. And there are possibilities in between. If you know that part of your data changes too fast, part of your data is stable, you cache the data that is stable, you access the data that changes. It's also possible. But you need to know the extremes so that you can figure out the middle idea. Okay. Now, in the case of biology, for example, the argument for online is because everybody has their separate sources, they are continually improving, continually modifying, and you want to get the correct, latest information. The second argument is there are legal issues. People do not want you to copy their database and put it in your home. Now you can say, you know, I mean, I can always live in some, you know, some country which has one computer and a domain name, and then, you know, there are no laws, and then you can break any laws. Okay, that's possible. But, you know, if you want to play by the rules, then you cannot say, and I just want to make a copy of your entire database, and nobody else will come to your database. Are you happy with it? They're normally not, okay? So it's illegal, for example, okay? A second issue, so basically you may not be able to copy it over. That's the reason they don't want to do it. But then there are people who are arguing that it should be copied over because individual databases, all of them have differing qualities, okay? One of the biggest problem is I can make today a movie database which is full of bogus information. And it's a movie database, you know. I mean, there's a question of, is this actually right? The tuples that I put, are they right or not? This is something that you don't have to deal with if you have your own database or your distributed database. Because all the tuples you put in, there's a guy who cleared them, presumably. Okay, so in biology, basically, they're also arguing that if you want to curate databases, right? Curation means somebody sits between people making the knowledge and people storing it. And say, this is looking funny and flaky, I don't want to put it in. And curation is actually better possible if you have a centralized warehouse database. And NIH is happy to, you know, hire lots of people who would help curate. So there are arguments for both, okay? So to avoid getting into any one direction, we'll read both. We'll actually talk about both. In some sense, I talked about everything that is there to talk about on the warehouse side, because there's very little there. In that sense, it's an easy solution. You know, you write a wrapper for each source, get the data, put it into, you know, you decide your schema up front and put it into that schema, and you're done. By the way, all the employment databases were based on this this kind of a data warehouse idea. And the most recent one that I sent you a copy of, I think I described recently, Google is now into this. Okay, Google want, and they just bought up a company which barely formed called Transformic. What they did was, they said, we are going to combine 4,500 employment opportunity data sources. I didn't know that there are that many, but apparently there are. So 4,500. And the only interesting problem that they had to solve is they did not have 4,500 graduate students maintaining 4,500 wrappers every night. They only had one or two. And so they instead tried to do a semi-automated way of writing wrappers. Actually, writing, not even wrappers, saying this field here corresponds to this field here in my database, which is sort of mapping, like the tagging that was happening, except now schema level tagging. Your field here corresponds to my field here. Okay, that's all they did. Turns out that's not easy to do. In fact, the easy part is easy to do, where if you know that one here corresponds to at most one here, it's easy to do. What if my centralized database has number of employees and average salary, and the data source has each employee and their salary? So some linear, non-linear combination of attributes here corresponds to one attribute here. It can be as interesting as you want. Most of the time in employment databases, that's not the case. So it's just name difference. And they essentially had, it's a painful thing. It's easy to do for one. It's painful to do for 4,500. And they found a couple of techniques, again, based on essentially quasi-learning techniques for mapping schema. Okay? So I'll stop here. We'll come back and take it up from here next class. Mostly, we'll spend a lot more time on the virtual integration, because that has a lot more technical problems. Okay? The other stuff, you know, you're ready to start your own company right now if you find some data that doesn't change too fast. You know, you can make your company. Good.